this is out of communications theory. This is part of the jargon of communications theory. If you have a labeled patient or an identified patient, an LP, which means that the family have gone to a shrink and asked the shrink to fix him because he's too much for them to handle, or whatever song and dance they give. And then he says, yeah, you're right, this guy's crazy, or this person has a problem, or has got something wrong with him. Now, that act of turning to a referee officially puts the stamp on the patient as the sick one. Now, he's the sick one, which labels, unlabels all the rest of them as the well ones. So we have the sick one and the well ones in the family system automatically by this business of going to a shrink who then pronounces a judgment and stamps the person as a certified nut. So this is a little different from the older view, or older uses of the word label, which you say that a person has been labeled schizophrenic. That is to say, has been given the so-called diagnosis by an official diagnosis, that does not mean what now is referred to as the labeled patient. Is that understood? The idea of the labeled patient is a new idea since 1950. Before it was, if the word was ever used, I don't think it was, the expression was never used before 1950. It was the diagnosed patient. And what Bateson and Haley were trying to do was to metaphorically showing that this person is nutty because somebody said he was. And which takes the family off the hook. Now they're well by definition or by exclusion. And I'm sure that's very reassuring to the significant others of a labeled patient to learn by default that they're just perfectly nifty people with no problems at all, except the problem member you can begin to understand a little bit, I think, why the idea of hyperkinetic child is so popular nowadays, because it gets the family off the hook. If some chemical dispenser says this child is a hyperkinetic child, or he has this minimal cerebral dysfunction, then that cures all the rest of the members of the family instantly, and they can heave a sigh of relief. And it's solemnified, or not solemnified, there's another word for it. It's not sanctified, but by giving chemicals to the labeled patient, that proves it beyond a shadow of a doubt that there's something very definitely and certainly wrong with the labeled patient, that you have to give chemicals to it. And if behavior seems to be better after the ingestion of these chemicals, then that removes any doubts whatsoever that there was something wrong, that there wasn't something wrong with this labeled patient. So it keeps reinforcing itself, and increasingly gets the rest of the people, the unlabeled patients, so that when I'm going to make up a rule now, the more physical the behavior seems to be, in the old sense of something wrong with the flesh itself, the less nutty are the rest of the members of the family, the more that disqualifies their part in this mad drama. So there are large rewards for everybody for the official determination that there's something physically wrong with the labeled patient. Big rewards on that. Okay, now, what is madness? Now, I'm claiming in advance that you know perfectly well, each of you knows perfectly well what madness is. You may, in a context of debate, pretend that you do not know that what that word means, but that if you were in another context where you are being asked what it means, say by a child or a younger person, then you would have no difficulty at all with, it would not occur to you at all that you don't know what that means. So even though I know that you know perfectly well what mad and madness and madman, what those expressions mean, I'm going to suggest some things called criteria, or benchmarks, or qualifications, or characteristics, I suppose. The first characteristic of a mad character tactic is that it's incessant or unceasing. The guy keeps on doing it. It's not a one-shot deal. May even do more of it as time goes by. Let's say he does it less and less frequently, so that it eventually stops, then you would not refer to it as madness. So what I'm talking about when I say the person is mad, or this is madness, or it's a mad sort of tactic, I'm talking about the recurrent, repetitive sort of thing. So when you read a paper about something that happened once, like some guy knocks off his wife, and that's it, well, don't bother with that paper. It doesn't have anything to do with the topic of madness. Now, in the Western world, courts of law, there is the provision that a person can be temporarily insane, and therefore his behavior is excusable on the grounds that he was, for the moment, out of his cotton picking head. He got carried away. He experienced what the legal egos call an irresistible impulse. And this is a legal idea, that it's reasonable to think of a person for a moment getting carried away, not being himself, so to speak, being out of his head for the moment, and doing something he shouldn't ought to do. And then, after a while, he gets his cool back and goes about his business, and will say, well, I just was out of my head, or I didn't know what I was doing, or I got carried away. So we have the concept, the legal concept of temporary insanity. So with that exception, where we do in fact say, well, that's mad, that guy's really, he went berserk and crazy. But he's no longer crazy. Then yes, we say that is madness, but it's only temporary. But we do not say that he is a mad person, whatever he did. It could be the most bizarre, atrocious act, and we will still say that if we have decided that he was only temporarily out of his mind, out of his head, bananas or bonkers, then we would say, well, it was just a passing thing. So first, then, the behavior is recurrent, unceasing, incessant, repetitive, recidivist behavior. The second character of madness is that the behavior is unreasonable. It's illogical. It doesn't make sense. Yeah.
I want to get back to the other point just for a second. I'd sure like to know your opinion on what this thing called a temporary insanity is.
You'd like to know my what?
Opinion. What you think of that?
Well, do I think people can do that sort of thing? Sure. Get lose control under many, many circumstances. A person can lose control and do it once and do some terrible things and then never do it again for the rest of their lives. And that is not, since there's nothing that you can study except the one event, there's really, it doesn't. It's not the proper subject matter of the study of madness. Now, I think that there are some cases where people get away with doing some pretty bad things. Offering that as an excuse, where some brute, let's say, beats up a relatively helpless person, and will claim that they got carried away, that they have such a terrible temper that they can't control their temper. But you follow that person around, you will notice that he never tees off on a lion. He doesn't lose his temper in the presence of a hungry lion or a gorilla or a person that would wipe him out if he lost his temper. He only loses his temper when his victim is unable to defend himself or herself. Now, that's phony baloney, in my view.
But the phenomenon occurs as far as you're concerned.
Sure, sure. Sometimes a person had a concussion. He got bonked on the bean, and there's residual. It takes him quite a while to recover from this, and when that happens, sometimes people
being drug-induced?
Sure. Drugs can... chemicals can do marvelous things to the nervous system. And I hope I can talk about that tonight. I want to give the holistic theory of chemical action. And that will remind me. Now, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. So now, benchmark of madness is that whatever the person doesn't make sense. It's illogical. It doesn't seem to serve any purpose.
Apparently.
On the surface, it doesn't. It seems to serve no purpose. It doesn't seem to serve the person doing it. Doesn't seem to get him anywhere. And indeed, it almost usually what he's doing gets him in deeper trouble than before he did it. He loses his job, his friends, his reputation, his future, all sorts of. There are all sorts of consequences, negative for the person who's doing it, whatever it is.
You just said future. That would be a lot only for himself. I'm really asking you, when you say that there's purpose in the behavior, so it has to be purpose in relation to others, and it's being its own purpose, like coming on death.
I don't know. Well, I'm talking about is for an observer of this behavior, the behavior doesn't seem to have consequences that the person wants. Okay, now let's start over again. What's the question? Understand the idea of something, of one relating. You can't relate to yourself. That's bollocks is up the idea of relationship.
But the idea you just said about a person's denying himself his future through his behavior, that might be subjective.
Well, may not be. Let's. You're mixing, I think, let's call them hidden purposes of behavior. That is to say, purposes are consequences that are not readily seeable. You can't see how doing this leads to anything, any advance that the person wants. And I guess I don't understand your question, so I shouldn't even try to answer it.
You say that it appears unreasonable.
That's what I said.
To me, what I think I hear the question being asked is that we've already agreed, I think, over the last two or three lectures, that behavior is teleological or has end or has purpose or has direction.
That's an assumption.
Yeah, and when you say unreasonable, it seems to wipe that away, and I think we should, clarify that.
I neglected to put this up here, but there are four characteristics of mad tactics that they appear to be unnecessary, unceasing. They appear to be unreasonable. Okay, now, does that change your question at all? Okay, now what's your question then?
The question is if by tactics you mean that we have to assume that behavior is in some way done in order to influence others around them, social.
Yeah. That is an assumption you may make. You don't have to, no. Deeds that knock you out, make you unaware of something.
Or, you know, just perpetually doing something you won't have to face.
Yeah. Example of a specific behavior. Okay, collecting newspapers would be you could construe that as unrelated to other people. I could construe it as very much related to other people. It's certainly very visible to other people. Necessarily, yes. That sort of behavior you can see. How'd you find out about it?
Okay, I'm sorry. In that case,
yeah.
If he were a person who had no one around him, he'd do that.
Well, we would never know that, would we? We don't know of anybody. Yeah, we don't know of anybody that knew about it. But just because we come in afterwards, don't know about anybody that knew about it, doesn't even for an instance prove that there wasn't somebody around that this was a message to.
Isolation
messages that I am isolated, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that would be relational, even though they're not relating.
That is, yeah. When one messages, I am isolated from you, that's a message. Now, in the case of the Grizzly Adamses, the hermits, who get out away from people so that they cannot communicate with them, we really don't have anything to say about them. There's no, we can't talk to them, we can't watch them. By definition, they are not within our observation. There's little point in speculating about what they're up to. We can hardly call them mad.
Is it too fictional to say that not only do we have a relationship with other people, but we have a relationship with the world, humanity, life?
No, I know that's doesn't make much sense, because then the word relationship gets bollocked up when you use it that way. You see, I have a relationship to life. Life is an idea, and I fail to see how a person can have a relationship with an idea. That doesn't make sense to me.
That's seems like if somebody who would be a hermit would be commenting on something.
Well, we'll never know. See, unfortunately, the person who removes himself from our observation makes it impossible for us to observe him, and since we have no behaviors to write to talk about, and then we have no behaviors to explain, there's really no problem. See, the hermit is not a problem. And he is so much not a problem that we can scarcely think of him as mad. We just can't do that. It doesn't make sense. Yes. Yes. That's it. Well, there's no point. You see, there's no way to. There's no way, and there isn't any reason to talk about, worry about people that aren't around to talk about, worry about. There's nothing we can say about them. And why should we say anything about them anyway? What's the point? Assume they didn't exist. I simply say I'm not interested in them, and neither are you.
Yeah, but you're cutting out a whole bunch of people from because.
That's right.
And whether or not their behavior fits what you're saying, but they're not problems. They're just.
Well, what I can't think of any reason to.
Isn't that just Kropotkin idea?
No, the burden of let's say the burden of proof rests upon you, not me, to show cause for examining the hermit. I can't think of any reason to worry about hermits. You apparently can. Okay, now I say, fine, let us hear these reasons and look at them.
Well, that a person who is not existing in relation to anyone else doesn't fit any of this, or does fit this.
But you haven't given me a reason to examine them.
Well, you're assuming that every behavior is tactical in relation to.
That's right. How can they behave in a manner similar to a person who is interacting with others when there is nobody to interact with?
Who's only behaving in the presence of others. Maybe doing the same kinds of things in the presence of others.
Well, maybe so. You have to write Alice in Wonderland in order to get your sentences on a piece of paper because there isn't any other way to do it. You're going to have to do some fantasy. Because that's all you got is fantasy.
Well, I could sneak out there with a video tape.
Okay, now you've raised a very important point, because especially when you get to the cats, the so-called catatonics, it would appear that their withdrawal is so, in some cases, so profound. That they are acting as if there ain't nobody around them. They are acting as if they are in a world of their own, peopled by nobody else. Maybe they have a private room in a sanatorium, and they go into their stupor, and you go in there, and 5 hours later you come back, and they're still sitting like this, you know. It's the way you put them. You stuck a tube down their mouth and feeding them. That's that. It raises the question. How is that behavior tactical? Well, you've got to be able to answer that question, because in the case of the catatonic, or in the case of stupor, who's got stupor? In the case of stupor, you got to think sharp when you have assumed that all behaviors All mad behaviors are tactical. You've got to think sharp when you get to the stupors. There's another one. Who's got anesthesia? The loss of feelings. Nobody? Oh, okay. Now it really gets rough on the tactical assumption. In fact, I think that the case of anesthesia does more damage to the tactical assumption than all the rest put together. What is anesthesia? No feelings. My eyeballs start rolling over and over and over again when I think about, when I try to answer the question, how can not feeling something get the person something they want unconsciously, when unconsciousness is the tactic? And I confess, I'm having a rough time with it. But I assert, even though I confess this, that does not force me back to the old.